This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. More anxiety for some customers of IndyMac. First, they waited in line for hours to withdraw money from the failed bank. Now, some will have to wait even longer to get their cash. That's because some other banks are requiring lengthy holds on IndyMac cashier's checks. Federal regulators say they're looking into the situation.
IndyMac was taken over by the FDIC last Friday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the frantic days leading up to that takeover.
Leon Russo had a feeling a week ago that all was not well at IndyMac. Russo is a financial planner in Ventura, California, where he oversees the treasury of a local nonprofit group.
They had amassed about $250,000 into this one bank, IndyMac.
Russo says it's always nerve-wracking to have so much money in one place, since only the first $100,000 is insured. But what really alarmed him last week was the steep drop in IndyMac's stock price.
A young fellow in my office told me that there was a 40-cent drop on the stock market on IndyMac. And when I went back to review everything, and because I hadn't been watching it that closely, it didn't look good.
It just so happened that the finance committee of Russo's nonprofit group had a meeting the next day, and he urged them strongly to pull their money out.
They were kind of wishy-washy back and forth, you know, we'll call the bank and yada yada. I said, no, you're not going to call the bank. You're going to go into the bank, you're going to have a cashier's check made, and that's that. It turned out, fortuitously, that that was Thursday, the day before they seized the bank. So it worked out really well. They think I'm a big hero and a genius, but I'm not really a genius, just got lucky.
Other nervous depositors were also pulling money out of IndyMac, and that loss of confidence created a vicious cycle. Early last week, IndyMac warned the Securities and Exchange Commission it was suffering from elevated levels of withdrawals. That warning triggered the stock drop that wound up spooking Russo. 12 days earlier, New York Senator Charles Schumer had written to bank regulators warning that a significant move by IndyMac's depositors to redeem their deposits could leave the firm in a disastrous financial situation. Bank analyst Jarrett Seaberg of the Stanford Group says once those letters became public, Schumer's worst fears were realized.
The irony in this whole situation is that Senator Schumer was trying to warn about a run on the bank when that very warning helped cause a run on the bank.
Anxious IndyMac depositors withdrew $1.3 billion in the 2 weeks between Schumer's alarm and the seizure of the bank last Friday. Frustrated regulator John Rich, who directs the Office of Thrift Supervision, complained on a conference call that while IndyMac was already in danger, the run on the bank made recovery impossible.
In effect, the deposit run sparked by the senator's letter pushed IndyMac over the edge.
Schumer, who chairs the powerful Joint Economic Committee, was quick to defend his role, saying IndyMac wouldn't have been in jeopardy had regulators gotten tough on the bank years earlier.
They are doing what the Bush administration always does, blame the fire on the person who calls 911.
Critics suggest Schumer effectively poured gasoline on the fire. But it's also clear that IndyMac was tinder dry and ready to burn. The bank had aggressively courted depositors with above-average interest rates in order to fund its mortgage business after Wall Street money dried up. Bank analyst Jamie Peters of Morningstar says depositors who turn to a bank just for high interest rates are quick to run at the first sign of trouble.
What you're referring to is what in the banking world is called hot money. If you compare an IndyMac depositor to somebody, say, at Wells Fargo, IndyMacs were much more prone to leave.
Federal regulators say they're paying close attention to banks that rely too heavily on any one source of funds, and they're encouraging banks to respond quickly to any rumors of big withdrawals. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Gloria Nunez lives in Fostoria, Ohio. She says she's been relying on Social Security disability checks ever since she had a car accident at age 23. Nunez is the focus of our story today as we explore the human dramas behind a survey on the economy.
That poll was conducted in Ohio and in Florida by NPR, the Kaiser Family Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health. Among its findings, about half of low-income people in Ohio say they've had a serious problem getting a good job. In the case of Gloria Nunez's family, some of them have part-time jobs and some are unemployed. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on how the economy is making it harder for them to find work.
The irony of Gloria Nunez's life is that she grew up in the auto industry, but doesn't own a car. Her father worked at GM for 45 years. Her mother taught driver's ed. Now, to get a lift from the subsidized housing complex where Nunez and most of her family live, they have to barter and trade or hitch rides. They're separated from most local employers by an interstate and several miles. Nunez has never worked. Her daughter, Angelica Hernandez, has held several jobs but can't seem to find one now. She says she tried saving to buy her own car last year, but since then, her mom's van died, she quit her job, and boom, those savings disappeared.
I was making good money working at McDonald's, but it wasn't worth me going all the way over there and coming all the way back because I'm wasting more gas money than doing that.
Now, gas costs more, few companies are hiring, and it's hard to get transportation to even get to an interview.
Like, this is the first time I have not been able to find a job right away. Like, I haven't worked in 3 months, and this is the first time in, like, 2 years, maybe, because I've always worked.
Typically, the only way out of this cul-de-sac is through Nunez's mother, Irma Hernandez.
What are you going to do after a while?
Ivan wants me to take her to Toledo to the lawyer. Mm-hmm. You need to go somewhere?
Yeah, I just needed to go to the store to get some light bulbs and stuff.
Bye, Mom.
At one time, there was only one car for all the five families, you know. And with my income and everything going up, I'm about to lose my car. So what's going to happen to us?
She's two car payments behind. Unemployment in the area is high and likely to get worse. Across the street from their housing complex, a ThyssenKrupp factory that makes diesel engine parts announced it's shutting down next year.
Like I said, I know people that do work here. They're going to lose their home, their car. I mean, this is their living. This is what they're living on.
400 jobs will relocate to Illinois. At midday, the parking lot is half empty, but Gloria Nunez says that's because many workers hitch rides to get to work.
Are there any businesses that are growing in Fosteria?
There ain't nothing growing but drugs and teen pregnancy. That's the only thing that's growing.
Drugs and trains. Locals say that's what you find in Fosteria. But the trains just pass through, whereas the drugs tend to trade on Poplar Street, a block from where Nunez's sister lives. Nunez usually goes to her sister when money and food have run out.
I tell her, can I come over there? She goes, yeah. And but I'm going to bring a bag. She said, you need some food. And I said, yeah. And I bring a bag, and she hooks me up for the end of the month. And she does that to all my brothers and sisters.
This despite the fact that Yvonne Gamma and the six others living in the house don't have jobs, nor do they have a working car.
You fight? Give me a gun.
Standing on her porch with her kids and grandchild, Gamma says she's simply more adept at making things last.
I'm about the only one in the family that I help more as much as I can. My family, my friends, I give them whatever they need.
Nunez says she's become accustomed to struggling. But it wasn't this way growing up. Her dad's GM income provided what they needed.
Do you feel like you've been able to give the same life to your kids?
No, I don't think I have. I wish I did. I wish I've had, but I wish we were still young again. Wish we could start all over again, but I can't. I mean, this is life. This is what you get.
Now she says she must stretch her remaining $20 another 3 weeks until she gets her next check. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
And at our website, you can see a breakdown of the household budgets of the families in our reports. You can also take a look at the full findings of our poll on how the economic downturn is affecting families. That's at npr.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This summer, as usual, high school graduates are searching for dorm room bedsheets or laptops for college. Others are getting their passports in order to head off on a kind of sabbatical. A growing number of students are taking what's called a gap year after they've been accepted into college, as NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
As a self-described perfectionist at one of the best prep schools around Boston, James Clark didn't really surprise anyone when he got into a bunch of top colleges. What was surprising was when he wrote back to his first choice saying he wasn't coming, at least for now.
I mean, unless I turn out to be
a rock and roll star, something like that. You know, I'll never have time to do whatever you want. And so I knew that I had to seize this opportunity, so.
Clark says he desperately needed time to get out of his books, as he puts it, and into the real world. So instead of hanging his corkboard in his freshman dorm, he's off this fall to do field research in the Tibetan mountains, martial arts in Tiananmen Square, and scuba diving somewhere in South America.
Here we go, the famous whale shark.
Clark says he can't wait to do what he wants without worrying what colleges will think, like he always had to do in high school.
You can't just say, oh, you know, this is what I want to do. I revised in my head, you know, saying, is this right? I want to do things a little bit differently than I have been doing them.
You want to loosen up a little.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I want to unwind.
Gap years have long been popular in Europe. In the U.S., there's no hard national data, but colleges, consultants, and travel abroad programs all say more kids are doing it. At Swarthmore, the number doubled this year. Dean of Admissions Jim Bach says he thinks overscheduled and overachieving kids are trying to reclaim the downtime that used to come naturally.
Summers have disappeared completely, sadly, because so many are doing things which they think will look good on a college application. And so I actually would say that gap year may be the new summer.
For some kids, the gap year means time to pursue a long-time passion. For others, like Nicola Rentschler, it's about pushing yourself into new territory. Never an animal person, she signed up to rehab wild penguins in South Africa.
You have to like wrangle, you have to hold them, they bite, they claw, you'd be surprised how many ways they can actually hurt you. It was sort of a confidence thing because I had to push myself completely out of my comfort zone. So
gap years vary in cost. Many kids work first at home to save the few thousand dollars they may need to teach English in Peru for a few months or help a beekeeper in France. Some parents are happy to foot the bill for that rather than let a kid who's not ready for college waste a full year's tuition. Schools say kids come back from gap years much more mature, ready to learn, and self-sufficient than they ever were when they graduated high school.
A lot of these kids are coming out with only one set of skills, and that is how to be a good student. You know, they need to sort of see that that doesn't really give you life skills.
Gail Reardon, a consultant with Taking Off, helps kids plan their gap years.
Hi, Georgina.
Hello.
How are you?
Reardon's business has more than tripled in the last few years as more kids take gap years and need help making it happen.
I really like the dolphin and turtle research in Mozambique.
Okay. Let me just ask you a question. Have you ever scuba dived?
No.
Okay, so before we get too far along...
Reardon likes to say gap years are about letting kids make their mistakes before their mistakes really count. But as gap year consultants and programs proliferate, consultant Stephen Roy Goodman says not all of them give kids that chance.
If everything is taken care of for a student, that does defeat some of the purpose of why we're engaged in this in the first place.
Others worry that gap year programs will become the exclusive province of upper middle class kids who already head to college with many advantages. Gap years tend to be more common with wealthier kids looking for the kind of grittier real world challenges that Johns Hopkins professor Stephanie DeLuca says other kids can't avoid.
For, you know, the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, the gap year, it's not called the gap year, you know, it's just called life.
Colleges say a gap year doesn't have to be costly. Students could intern with a state representative or work in a national service program. But the concern was enough that Princeton University is planning to actually subsidize students who spend a year doing public service. It's hoping to convince 10% of freshmen to take a year off before starting college. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Let's say you're an executive at one of Hollywood's biggest studios, and one of your most beloved franchises is lifeless thanks to a string of uninspired sequels. To revive it, what do? Hire a proven A-list director, or hire a young man whose biggest claim to fame is Memento, the low-budget independent thriller with a story that's told backwards? Well, Warner Brothers chose the latter, and Batman was reborn in 2005 with the hugely successful Batman Begins. And tomorrow, that young man, director Christopher Nolan, returns to theaters with his second Batman movie, The Dark Knight, another round for the Batgear and high-tech heroics.
Well, I must say, compared to your usual requests, jumping out of an airplane is pretty straightforward.
And what about getting back into the plane?
I'd recommend a good travel agent.
Without it landing.
Now that's more like it, Mr. Wayne.
That's Morgan Freeman as Lucius Fox and Christian Bale as Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. the Batman. The film also stars the late Heath Ledger as the Joker. Ledger died unexpectedly after filming ended. But back to director Christopher Nolan. I asked him recently how he tried to make this well-worn franchise feel fresh.
It is a challenge with pre-existing iconography, but what you get in exchange for that challenge of how to make something fresh is you get access to an audience association with the characters that lets you tell a story on a very grand scale, in a very operatic manner, that you couldn't with fully original characters that people were seeing for the first time.
You're working on themes of good and evil, the relationship between Batman and the Joker, and perhaps some ambiguity about morality and immorality. Can a Batman movie sustain that kind of gravitas, or is it simply in the end it's an adaptation of a comic book character?
Well, I like to think it can be both. It's really for the audience to decide what they get out of the film. But for me, it's always been paramount that the film first and foremost be a great piece of entertainment. But to make this kind of action movie entertaining, I feel that I have to take the subject matter very seriously. I have to invest all of my attention and focus in a very sincere way for a couple of years while I make the film. That, I think, is what hopefully will make the best film and hopefully will make the most entertaining film, because the things in the movie are, in some sense, somebody believed in them. That's the feel that I most respond to in a large blockbuster, and that was very much what I wanted to bring to the telling of the Batman story.
I mean, if you slipped into treating it like just a comic book story, you know, if we saw POW explode on the screen or something, in a way, that doesn't work. You have to take it more seriously than that.
I believe you do, not for any highfalutin reasons, really just so that as a viewer, when I go to see one of these films, I'm always a little bit let down. I'm always a little bit frustrated when the filmmaker sort of winks at me. Mm-hmm. I feel a bit like that's for me to decide, you know, whether there's something inherently amusing about the genre. I want the filmmakers to have fully invested in the process of telling a story.
You, by your own description, you in making a movie, you are the surrogate for the audience, for the person who's going to get to see this in the movie mm-hmm. theater down the road. In that case, do you have to think like a teenage boy for 7 months while you're making it, to put yourself in the mind of the people who will make or break The Dark Knight?
I think movies are more visceral and emotional than some other media. So I think that it's not really a question of having to think exactly like a teenage boy or whatever your target audience is. But I think that where large-scale movies really come into their own is when they speak a universal language, when they tap into more universal emotions and responses. But certainly, I try and think about the way I would have viewed this film as a boy. I think in making films, I'm really trying to sort of recapture that sense of things.
So they have a lot of whoa moments going on in the movie. A lot of moments where you kind of rise out of your seat and say, whoa, look at that.
I think that's actually really the aspiration of this kind of filmmaking, is that there will be a couple of moments in the film where you really, it does make you want to applaud or cheer or whatever. I think that's a very important sort of milepost in the journey of a film like this.
Talk about the character of the Joker, played in the movie by the late Heath Ledger. A Joker very much unlike Jokers we've seen before. What's the idea that you and your screenwriting partner and brother had here?
Really, we wanted him to be the most frightening possible version of this character, the sort of edgiest possible. And what I talked with Heath a lot about when we first met was the idea of him being a force of pure anarchy, of being someone who wouldn't play by any kind of rules, even criminal rules, somebody who wouldn't in any way be bound by the convention of society, that he should be after something, he should have a plan and so forth. What Heath had to do, and I think he did it in a really incredible way, is he had to balance the need for the Joker to be an iconic presence, but be a human being and be somebody that you can listen to and believe that this is really how they operate, this is really how they view the world. The flip side of that, though, is that you don't want to know too much about them as a human being. You don't want to humanize them too much, because what Heath and I talked about a lot was with these sort of great villains, whether it's Darth Vader or Hannibal Lecter or whoever, what we've sort of found is the more you find out about who they were as people, the less threatening, the less interesting, really, they are.
So there's got to be a mystery about the character for it to
work. I think, well, mystery also, there has to be a sense of absoluteness of the fully formed character. This is not an origin story for the Joker. The Joker, I like to say, you know, that in this film, the Joker moves through the story like the shark in Jaws. He's an absolute. It's not so much a mystery about the character. You're not sitting there wondering who his parents were, where he came from, and we sort of riff on that in the movie. He simply is the force of chaos who's going to test every character in this story, and I think you know that from the very first second you see him.
Do you remember the moment when you decided, I want to make movies, this is what I'm going to do in my life?
Not really. I mean, I started making sort of Super 8 films when I was about 7 years old with my older brother, Matt. And the truth is, it's sort of ever since then, it's been something that fascinated me and something that I've done in one form or another. So it's been a sort of organic, just a growth, really. I mean, I've just, made larger and larger and hopefully better and more interesting films.
What did you make the Super 8 movies of when you were 7 years old?
Well, starting when I was seven, before I'd seen the first Star Wars, they were sort of military things using, you know, Action Man, which is the English G.I. Joe figure. And then, of course, as soon as Star Wars came out, that changed everything. And I think I made a series of films called Space Wars, very imaginatively titled Space Wars. That was what we did for years. It was all about models and blowing things up. And
oh, you mean you were working with miniatures in part?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have your little Star Wars toys and you strap firecrackers to Millennium Falcon and blow it up and film it and see what you get.
Yeah. Well, it's not that far off from from what's happening in The Dark Knight.
It's done on a rather larger scale, and it's not actually me, thankfully, having anything to do with the pyrotechnics, but it's just something I've always done and something I just really get a kick out of.
Chris Nolan, thanks a lot for talking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
To hear more of my interview with director Christopher Nolan, including the story of a cameo by a fabled thespian talent, Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, go to npr.org. The Dark Knight opens tomorrow. From our studios in Gotham, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.